The war in Iraq.
I know people that are in the army and people who have like died because of it, so it's just kind of like a horrible thing.
Rising college costs.
Affordable is not a term I would use to describe college these days.
And concerns about the economy, including fears about the cost of getting sick.
I don't really know how I'd be able to pay for that without insurance.
These are the issues students say they'll be thinking about when they cast their ballots Tuesday. I'm Ann Sanner. Welcome to iElect. I'm one of the 22 journalism students who will be giving you an inside look at what's influencing the youth vote. Please join me for the next hour as our reporting team shares the results of our research. But first, this news update.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Security and the war on terrorism have been the focus of the presidential candidates as they stump in battleground states on this last weekend of the campaign. Democratic nominee John Kerry was in Wisconsin this morning as he began a five-state weekend blitz. NPR's Andrea Seabrook is traveling with the Kerry campaign.
Hundreds of Kerry's supporters gathered on this chilly autumn day in Appleton, Wisconsin. Kerry told voters that President Bush made a mistake in his execution of military operations after September 11, 2001.
It was wrong to divert our forces from Afghanistan so that we could rush to war in Iraq without a plan to win the peace.
Kerry's press secretary later told reporters that Mr. Bush's rush into Iraq, quote, left Osama bin Laden free to wander the globe. Senator Kerry did not speak specifically of the recent video of Osama bin Laden, but he did tell the ralliers that Democrats and Republicans alike are united in their determination to capture or destroy bin Laden. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, with the Kerry campaign in Des Moines, Iowa.
President Bush also has been campaigning in Wisconsin today. He told a crowd at one rally that he offers leadership and results for a time of threat.
If America shows any uncertainty or any weakness in this decade, the world will drift toward tragedy. This is not going to happen on my watch.
Mr. Bush said the election will set the direction of the battle against terrorism. The head of the Department of Homeland Security says the nation's alert level will remain where it is for now. Tom Ridge says Americans should have no concern about voting safely on Tuesday.
Our effort nationwide down to the local level to enhance security is ongoing. We are far safer today than we've ever been before.
Even Ridge's appearance in casual clothes seemed designed to convey a lack of alarm after the recent bin Laden tape. That videotape was aired by Al Jazeera, the satellite channel, after being dropped off at its Pakistan office. The tape was broadcast over the objections of U.S. diplomats. Kate Seely reports.
Al Jazeera officials said the tape was left in a package at the front gate of their Islamabad office. The first video of the al-Qaeda leader in more than a year, it shows a fit-looking bin Laden appealing to the American people. Pakistan's interior minister said authorities have no information about the tape's source. He denied rumors that bin Laden may be hiding in Pakistan. Meanwhile, the U.S. military in Afghanistan insisted the al-Qaeda leader would be caught, but acknowledged it had no fix on bin Laden's whereabouts. For NPR News, I'm Kate Seely in Beirut.
8 U.S. Marines were killed and 7 others wounded when a car bomb exploded outside Fallujah today. It was the bloodiest attack on U.S. forces in Iraq in months. And in Baghdad, another car bomb was detonated outside the office of an Arab TV network, killing 7 people. This is NPR News from Washington. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has undergone a series of medical tests in France. Senior aides to the 75-year-old Arafat say despite his serious condition, there is no immediate risk of him dying, and so far the tests do not prove that he has leukemia. Democrats in Florida say the Republican Party there is planning to send more poll watchers to predominantly black and minority precincts on Tuesday than to white precincts in an effort to intimidate voters. But the GOP insists it is not targeting precincts by race. NPR's Libby Lewis reports.
Congressman Kendrick Meek told reporters the figures from election officials in 5 Florida counties prove the GOP is targeting minority voters with poll watchers on Election Day. A Kerry campaign spokesman said Republicans plan to have poll watchers at 100% of predominantly black precincts in DeSoto County, while they plan to have poll watchers at only 15% of mostly white precincts there. In Miami-Dade, the GOP plans to have one or more poll watcher at 59% of mostly minority precincts, compared with 37% of mostly white precincts. A Republican spokeswoman did not dispute the figures, but she said Republicans are planning to target precincts where the GOP ran strongest or weakest in the 2000 election. Libby Lewis, NPR News.
The Boston Red Sox victory in the World Series this week was a long time coming, so the city went overboard in its celebration today. More than 3 million people turned out. The team paraded through the streets aboard amphibious vehicles, which then rolled into the Charles River for a further procession. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org.
Welcome back to I Elect, a special program examining the issues influencing the youth vote. I'm Ann Sanner. As students, we thought we understood what issues might be important to our peers, but we didn't want to rely on our instincts alone. So, as part of the iElect project, we surveyed students at the University of Illinois so they could tell us what they see as the key issues in this election year. Joining us to explain how the survey was conducted is iElect reporter Ivana Young.
And we sent the survey to more than 1,000 students on a University of Illinois campus. 394 students responded. Joining me to discuss the details of how the survey was developed is University of Illinois professor Eric Meyer. He was an editor for the Milwaukee Journal newspaper and serves as a news media research consultant. Professor Meyer helped design the iElect survey, so will you please explain how the survey was developed?
The survey was developed by looking over a lot of previous research that was done by other people looking into the issue of why college-age people do or don't vote and what motivates them. It was developed as a random sample of all the people at the University of Illinois who list their email addresses in public directories. An interval sample, every 35th one was sent an email, asked about the issues. It's an unusual survey in that the students never asked about who they were going to vote for or other issues that a lot of surveys ask. The point of the survey was more to get at issues and what was important and what might be motivating people to vote and use it as a reporting tool rather than as an end unto itself.
How do we know it was scientific?
Well, the survey has some limitations. Any survey does. Is it scientific by the standards of academic peer-reviewed journals? No, it's not. Is it scientific by the standards of what you would hear on the evening news? Yes. We, in fact, compared the methodology used to the methodology used by the Harris Organization, by Princeton Research, which does polls for NBC News. We had a better response rate than Princeton does. We had a better completion rate than Princeton does as well. So we considered it fairly accurate. As with anything, you don't get 100% of the people you've sampled to come back. We would have preferred to get a little higher number, probably a little over 40%. We, in fact, were stuck a little bit under 40%. One of the things we did do was be able to look to see how many people who had viewed the survey chose not to answer the survey after seeing what the questions were. That was a very small number, so we don't think that we have too much of a problem with completion rate problems that would tend to make survey results polarized in favor of particular opinions.
Why was it important to this project?
It was important because it helped identify what sorts of issues were important and what played on making those issues important. Issues, whether they were motivated by things that are affecting students directly or whether they were motivated by just simple concern about the issues.
University of Illinois journalism professor Eric Meyer, who helped design the iElect survey.
Now that we know how the survey was developed, let's take a look at what the results indicate. Here's iElect's Emily West.
Many of the newscasts we hear or see these days devote much of their time to reports about a shaky economy and a nation at war. And it turns out that based on our iElect survey results, the economy and the war are two of the top three issues important to U of I students. University of Illinois political science professor Scott Althaus says what students care about is in step with the rest of the nation.
The issue priorities of how important different things are to people on campus is pretty much in line with national surveys that show the top three issues of concern to voters in this election.
And as an indication of how important these issues are to students, 84% of University of Illinois students surveyed by iElect told us the war in Iraq is important. Althaus says today's media is responsible for keeping students in tune with what is happening in Iraq.
Most of us don't know people who are over there serving, and we can keep the war at arm's length unless we choose to seek out information through television, through newspapers, through the internet.
The economy is another issue that ranks high with college students. 89% of iElect respondents think that the economy is a big issue in the upcoming election. Statistically, the economy tied with the war in Iraq and higher education as one of the top three issues of concern to young voters. Former Illinois Governor Jim Edgar says today's youth are more in touch with reality than his generation.
We were very idealistic. I don't think we were very pragmatic. I think college students today are much more pragmatic.
And he says he can't believe today's youth care so much about the economy.
My sense is when I was in college in the 60s, I would have been shocked if the economy would have been high because we didn't think about those things.
University of Illinois political science professor Jim Nolan is just as surprised as Edgar.
I think the fascinating result from this is that it confirms that for college students as well as the larger electorate, the economy still, although statistically insignificant, is more important than the war in Iraq.
Higher education rounds out the top three issues that the students believe are important at 85%. And our survey results found out more than just what issues college voters believe are important. It also asked students to explain how they form their political beliefs. For 55% of the students surveyed, family influence topped the list of important factors. Edgar says he's glad to see families today are discussing politics.
I'm a little impressed that family's that high. I grew up in a family where we didn't talk politics.
But Nolan says he was not surprised to see family play such a big role.
The importance family plays in the influence upon the views of college students, and that is probably something I would have expected to see, but it probably both makes sense in terms of personal relationships and maybe in terms of respect for parents.
Regardless of how their political beliefs are formed, Althaus says college students seem to be informed voters.
I think people fundamentally recognize when an issue is a big issue and when it's not.
Even if the young people are politically aware, it is no guarantee that they will actually vote. The 18 to 25-year-old age demographic doesn't have the best record for voter turnout. I'm Emily West.
Now that we understand what's important to students and how they form their political views, let's get right into the issues students identified as important in our iElect survey. With a look at how students view the war in Iraq, here's reporter Rebecca Klopp.
Iraq War veteran Sergeant Alfredo Vargas went into Iraq not knowing what to expect.
The mentality we had once we came in is like, we don't come in here expecting to die. We don't come in here expecting to get shot. Whatever is going to happen, whatever happens is going to happen.
Most don't expect a college freshman to be contemplating their own death. Vargas was only 17 when he signed up for the National Guard, a good way, he thought, to pay for college.
You serve 1 weekend out of the month and 2 weeks in the summer, which, you know, that's... pretty easy, but I never thought I was going to be activated for so long.
Instead, September 11th happened, followed by U.S. deployments in Afghanistan and Iraq. And since then, Vargas has spent more time carrying a gun than at the books. He was first sent to O'Hare International Airport for military police duty, then to the Iraq War. 9 months into his tour in Iraq, Vargas got hurt.
I actually didn't walk for about a week. I was in a rollover accident in the Humvee. My Humvee flipped over and I got rocked.
He suffers from muscle and nerve damage to his lower back that he needed 7 months of rehab to recover from. Vargas now spends his days thousands of miles from the Iraq War, but can't seem to escape the political war being waged at home. According to iElect.com's survey, the war is one of the top issues for students at the U of I.
It's big. It affects people's lives. People are dying. Mm-hmm. So you have to be responsible about that.
One of my best friends, he just got back from over there, and he was in the heart of fighting. And I don't know, it's just, he was always on my mind.
I know people that are in the Army and people who have, like, died because of it. Just, like, people are dying for no reason. And not fair to anyone.
It seems to be what they're talking about mostly. I mean, they are talking about other issues, but it's the main thing at the moment. That's like the biggest influence, because it's the biggest thing that's going on.
U of I sociologist Michael Biggs says it isn't uncommon for college students to become political activists when there's a war.
The idea of coming to college is to get a slightly broader view of the, your own sort of selfish interests or self, you know, what is directly related to you and your own life. And so I guess college students have often felt that they're the ones who need to stand up for the for things that they believe in, even if it's not directly related to themselves.
That's especially true for war.
War is, for starters, a moral issue. It's about death and killing. So it's obviously something that is going to arouse people's passions much more than the economy, which is much harder to frame in moral terms. The deficit, for example, I mean, that's a very abstract notion.
But military historian John Lynn isn't as quick to point to a student's interest in the war as activism. Instead, he says there are media ties to the hype.
The economy's stupid, it's the war stupid. I mean, that's the ultimate issue right now. You could see the way both candidates are playing it.
At the local Champaign VFW, Vietnam veteran Steve Nunn talked about how similar both the fighting situations are.
The other guys in Iraq right now, they're in a concrete jungle. It's the same jungle. Same situation going on. You don't know where to turn. You don't know who's going to get you.
Yeah.
Nunn and his friend Harold Pettyjohn both say they're proud of their time in Vietnam, but they didn't like what went on around it.
It was a political war. That's all there was to it.
Nunn and Pettyjohn both feel the Iraq War is not another political Vietnam. But Vargas says politics sometimes get mixed in with the fighting.
We're there for oil. And the thing is, you know, once you're there and you see the good things that are coming out of the fact that, you know, we might have gotten there on bad intentions, but what we're actually doing there and the way it's benefiting, you know, the Iraqis that are there. We've built so many brand new schools. Their economy is slowly but surely starting to come up.
Political scientist and Vietnam War veteran Joe Miller says for veterans of war, it is more about the people in it than the politics surrounding it.
War, it's about your buddies, and it's about wanting them to be safe, wanting them to come home. And also, if you've lost friends, not wanting them to have died for no reason.
With over 60% of the military between the ages of 18 and 30, and 700 students at the U of I in the military, many university students on campus and across the country have a story similar to Vargas's. Perhaps with a sister, a brother, a cousin, or even a friend abroad, their minds might be on those faces as they go to the polls. I'm Rebecca Clough.
As we mentioned, while the war in Iraq is important to students, it isn't more important than the state of the economy. For college students, concerns about the economy often translate into concerns about whether they'll be able to find good jobs. For decades, a college degree has often guaranteed better jobs, higher wages, and comfortable lifestyles. But that has not been the case recently for some college graduates. ILX's Yesenia Maharo has more on this story.
Ben King is a waiter and bartender at Chili's Grill and Bar in Peoria.
I mean, I gotta pay the bills somehow.
King graduated from the University of Illinois in 2001 with a computer engineering degree, and he didn't think he would have to work in the same type of jobs he had in high school. King says he applied to at least 100 computer engineering jobs in the 6 months after he graduated, with no success. He went to job fairs in Chicago, Denver, Peoria, Bloomington, and Springfield, but he says he received rejection after rejection from company recruiters.
I was by far the youngest person there at a lot of them because they were competing for the same jobs as people that had 15, 20 years experience. I mean, they'd look at my resume and basically turn me around and squirt me out the door.
A recent survey of University of Illinois students conducted by the ILX Student Election Project about political issues indicates that the job market and economy are as important to students as the war in Iraq and the war on terror. 18-year-old Danielle Crum was among the students who ranked the economy as the number one issue in the election.
It also worries me because I'm afraid that when I graduate, there's not going to be a lot of opportunities, even though I have the degree and I worked so hard for it.
The head of the Collegiate Employment Research Institute at Michigan State University, which researches employment trends for college students, says they have reason to worry. Philip Gardner says a downturn in the economy in 2001 that resulted from the dot-com bust and September 11 left many college graduates unemployed or underemployed.
Well, the manufacturing sector had turned down.
way, a long time ago, and it was very slow with no retirement and the transition to some outsourcing, but more building in higher levels of technology in use of technology just has replaced a lot of labor in the manufacturing sector, and that's a traditional place to go to for engineers, and there just hasn't been any a rebound there yet enough to absorb all the engineers.
In particular, Gardner says the information technology market continues to be slow. Cisco Systems, one company within the IT market, makes the equipment used to route traffic over the internet. Spokesman John Earnhardt says the company is starting to hire again, following a three-year hiring freeze.
There's a lot of business coming in that just pretty much on a dime stopped.
Earnhardt says after laying off about 10,000 employees in 2001, the company will add about 1,000 new jobs over the next year. But that won't help Caleb Kitzman, a graduate of the U of I at Springfield, who dreams of working in sales. He's now employed as a lawn aerator.
I run behind a machine that pulls like small cylinder-shaped pieces of dirt out of the ground. That causes air and water to get to the root system, to the grass roots. Your yard's going to be much healthier that way.
Even as a lawn aerator, Kitzman has not lost his salesman touch. Kitzman says he applied to more than 30 jobs after graduation, most in sales, and got a lot of rejection letters. He turned to temporary employment because he had bills to pay. Michigan State University's Philip Gardner says the situation is not hopeless for people like Kitzman. Based on early results from his annual survey on the employment trends for college students, he sees a glimmer of hope for the graduating class of 2005. He expects more jobs to become available by then.
They may not have their perfect job. They're going to have to get in the labor market. There'll be jobs.
That good news may not be limited to accounting, business, tourism, and communication majors. These are the sectors where Gardner is starting to see improvement. He says education and nursing have remained untouched by the recession and will continue strong. I am Yesenia Mojaro.
Like Caleb Kitzman and Ben King, students responding to the ILEC survey say experiencing economic hardship influences how they rank the importance of the economy. And they aren't just worried about whether they'll be able to put their college education and newly acquired skills to good use. They're also concerned about other aspects of the changing economy. ILEC's Ryan Hubbard has more on this story.
In today's economy, recent graduates may find it harder to get health insurance than it is to get a job. You met Caleb Kitzman earlier. He graduated from the University of Illinois at Springfield with a degree in communications this spring. He knows exactly what it's like to end up in the hospital without health insurance.
I had my stomach pumped and I did not have insurance at that time.
Without insurance, Caleb could not afford the high cost of the hospital bills.
So I dodged my hospital bills, and then it was handed over, ironically, it was handed over to a collection agency. That added $700 onto my bill, so it went to $3,500. And that was really an eye-opening experience.
4 years later, Caleb is still paying off his hospital bill, and Caleb's situation is not uncommon in today's economy. A study done this year by the Commonwealth Fund finds that more than 40% of new college graduates live without health insurance for several months after graduation. As a result, many college graduates like Caleb are starting to make health benefits a priority when looking for a job. Caleb is settling for a temporary job in lawn care because his employer offers health insurance.
That's something I need to be responsible with and find a career that's going to offer some kind of benefit so I don't have to depend on my parents and the fact that I couldn't depend on them anymore.
Insurance agencies and politicians compare the health care concerns of young Americans with people who lose health insurance when they take early retirement and aren't yet eligible for Medicare. One option available that many U of I students don't know about is offered by the university. It extends the insurance coverage that they had as students. Donna Curtin is a supervisor of the U of I Student Insurance Office.
All students have an option to do one extension after their last semester in which they were assessed fees. Graduating students have the option of two semesters. This is simply extending the same plan that you have under the university for the same cost.
Politicians say better health care legislation could also help young Americans who find a job but do not receive health insurance from their employer. Matt Nabriza is managing partner of a small champagne business.
As a small business, it's just too expensive to give all of our employees health insurance.
Illinois State Representative candidate Deb Finan, a Republican running in the 103rd District, favors a plan that would group small and medium-sized companies to give them the same purchasing power as a large corporation.
Perhaps something similar for students and grad students, where you allow students and grad students who within a certain amount of time of graduation or starting grad school again could be part of a consortium where then they could purchase health insurance together as a group, which would allow costs to come down for everybody.
Her opponent, incumbent Democratic Representative Naomi Jacobson, says the issue has also been on her radar screen for a while.
In fact, I sponsored legislation that is setting in motion now the opportunity for small businesses to be able to pool together so that they can buy health care coverage for their employees and make it much more affordable and accessible.
Jacobson and Finan seem to agree that this legislation could take health care in Illinois in a better direction, ultimately making it easier for young Americans to get cheaper, more accessible health coverage. But Socialist Equality Party candidate Tom Mackeman, also running in the 103rd District, says Jacobson and Finan are not being honest about the issue and says the government needs to put social needs before money-making.
The problem is fundamentally a problem that puts private profit above the human needs of people. Things are getting a lot worse. They're not getting better.
While government officials say they are working on the issue, experts urge young Americans to carefully research all options available. I'm Ryan Hubbard.
Healthcare isn't the only thing costing more these days. For students like U of I sophomore Jessica Taylor, it's getting harder each year to piece together a plan to pay for college because tuition is rising across the country.
My parents pay for it. There's three of us in school. My sister goes to UIC downtown. I'm here. My brother's in a private Catholic school. We don't have anything, no grants, no loans, no financial aid, no scholarships, just straight out the pocket.
U of I freshman Matt Locus says he's on his own when it comes to paying for college.
I have student loans that I have to go through, and then I'll be able to just pay those back as soon as I'm done with everything here. It's going to be hard because I'm going to have to get a pretty decent job as soon as I get out, but if I do that, then I'll be fine.
And U of I freshman Emily Mills says she and her parents are trying to pay as she goes through school.
My parents have an agreement worked out with me where they pay for two-thirds and I pay for one-third. I have a job during the summer and I've had a job since I was 14 to save up money. I had this year saved up and I'm not really sure what I'm going to do for next year, so it might be interesting this summer.
ILX Christy Blandford explains that students are also worried about what they describe as a shortage of financial services, such as federal grants and financial aid.
College is becoming more expensive. A study by the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education, a nonpartisan organization, graded college affordability an F nationwide. And students say that with tuition rising and not enough federal aid, they have a hard time paying for college. University of Illinois student Megan McLeod has both grants and loans to help her pay tuition and rent, but that's not enough. She also has to work 30 hours each week and two jobs to pay for school.
Affordable is not a term I would use to describe college these days because, I mean, when the majority of the students that I know are working two jobs, actually a few of them working three jobs just to pay for it, I mean, it can't be that affordable.
McLeod predicts she will have to pay back about $56,000 in loans after she earns her undergraduate and graduate degrees.
When there's not a whole lot of grants, you tend to end up having a whole lot of loans. And then students are 21 and 22 years old coming out of college, and they have thousands and thousands of dollars worth of debt, and that's not the best way that you want to start out your life.
Both President George W. Bush and Senator John Kerry are promising to make college more affordable if elected. Bush wants to increase federal Pell Grants by $1,000 for students who qualify for the grant and allow first-year students to take out an additional $375 in federal loans. Kerry wants to provide a tax credit on tuition, so a student or his or her parent could deduct up to $4,000 from their taxes. He also wants to offer full tuition scholarships for students who agree to teach in poor school districts, like the Chicago Public Schools, and for students who will work as police officers to protect Homeland Security. UIUC Financial Aid Associate Director Victor Martinez says financial aid just isn't cutting it. He says as tuition rates climb, the federal government should kick in more money to help students pay for college, and if each candidate's plans come to fruition, they could help some students.
The number of students applying for financial aid has been increasing, and even though some of the allocations are there, they are not enough for they to be able to provide increases to the student Pell Grant, that is the main fund for on the federal government.
If these plans do not become reality, Martinez says some students could have to seek alternative loans through banks to help pay for college, which could lead to a lot of debt after graduation.
We're talking affordability, being able to come to school and not get involved with too many loans. And a situation like that, I would say that is getting a little bit more difficult. Loans, yes, there are some loans that are available for the student. Unfortunately, even with the loans, the student, in a lot of the cases, are not able to comply with all the expenses that are required by the different colleges in the country.
Chris Carroll graduated from the U of I's College of Law in 2003. Now a patent lawyer in Chicago, he's working to pay off about $90,000 worth of loans he accumulated during his time at the university.
Basically, I think pretty much all of my school-related expenses were either through the loans or through just part-time work.
And he says when the interest rates dropped, he refinanced his loans, which lowered his monthly payments.
I think it's been easier for me than probably people in the past, just because, with the interest rates kind of dropping off the face of the earth, I was able to refinance when I did graduate, and that really helped out, especially looking at what my monthly payments would have been versus what they are. I mean, obviously, having to pay back a loan, I am definitely, I'm giving up things, but so far it hasn't prevented me from doing anything that I would have like to do or needed to do.
Still, he will be paying those debts back for years to come.
When I refinanced it, I did it for as long as I possibly could, just because, like I said, the interest rate was such a good deal. It was so low that I wanted to basically take advantage of it. So I don't know if it's, I can't remember if it's a 20 or 30 year extension, but it's a long time.
Carroll says his $90,000 in college loans doesn't seem like much compared to what some other college graduates owe.
Being an attorney up here in Chicago, I see a lot of people who, spent, in a year, two, three, four times what I spent for school expenses. And, they got a degree from a private school or a much more expensive school, and they have the exact same job I do that pays the exact same amount of money, and they work the same amount of hours, but yet they're student loans are astronomical compared to mine.
Candidates Bush and Kerry both say they'll make it easier for students to afford college, but Megan McLeod says more has to be done to help students pay for school. She says if schools keep raising tuition, more financial aid might not cut it.
Every year they decide that they need to raise tuition, and even though they just raise it a little bit every year, by the time you get to your fourth year, it's raised quite a bit.
We also need to point out that the amount of state funding for public universities, particularly in Illinois, has continued to decline in recent years, even decades. That means tuition is making up a bigger slice of the university's funding pie. I'm Christy Blanford.
And as Christy explained, the presidential candidates have ideas on how to help make college more affordable, and students can have a voice at the ballot box. However, historically, students haven't had much of a voice. The Voting Rights Act Amendment of 1970 lowered the voting age to 18. Immediately, 25 million voters between the ages of 18 and 24 got their chance to speak out on Election Day. Since then, youth voter turnout has dropped from 50% in 1972 to 36% in 2000. Different organizations and academics are trying to figure out why the youth don't vote in greater numbers. With the 2004 presidential election just days away, iElect talked to two eligible college-age voters, both 19-year-old University of Illinois students. The first is political science student Justin Cajendos, who says he's passionate about politics. He sees it as a means to improve the public good.
And that's one of the reasons I'm involved in politics, so that I can, make progress on issues that I care deeply about.
Justin says his parents' experiences living in the Philippines' totalitarian government compels him to vote.
In that country, you know, they didn't have the right to vote, they didn't have the right to exercise the freedom of speech. You know, having parents that grew up in that situation gives me a greater appreciation for our country and for the rights that we have here. And that's why I think it's so important that people should vote.
U of I nuclear engineering student Cole Richter is our other eligible voter. And he says, don't expect to see him at the polls in November.
I don't want to vote this year because I don't feel like there's a good enough choice for me to pick a candidate. I don't feel like I have enough of an opinion on enough of the topics in order to select a candidate that would be able to represent our country.
Cole says his parents' political discussions sometimes filled his home life, but they weren't frequent or heated. His mother, Ellen Richter, says she's happy her views haven't influenced Cole's opinions.
At this point, I think that he is feeling that the political process does not affect him. My hope and his father's hope is that he will become more involved in this critical part of all of our lives. And that when he does, he will make the decisions according to the way we raised him, which was to be free-thinking and a good moral citizen.
Both students look at life, especially political life, in different ways. As Americans, they're free to choose whether to vote or not to vote. Dr. Thomas Patterson researches why people decide to vote or not to vote. Patterson is the author of The Vanishing Voter. He says, in some cases, family does have a strong influence on political identity.
There's a tendency for people, when they adopt a party loyalty, to pick up the party identification of their parents. And, you know, it's not one-to-one. It doesn't happen in every case, but it happens in a lot of cases. And that's the most direct way that parents influence the vote choice.
That could mean voting habits and political interest is generational.
If you're growing up in a household where the parents vote, pay attention to politics, talk about politics, you develop the political interest that is almost necessary for most people to take part in elections. They've got to have at least some interest in politics, and much of that is acquired quite early in life, in childhood.
And other factors can have a similar impact. Religion has historically played a significant role in politics.
Religion for a long period in American politics competed with economic class as one of the two main influences on the American voter. And then that diminished substantially during the period of the Great Depression. Religion didn't immediately kind of come back as a strong force, but it did when issues presented themselves that took on religious overtones. The banning of prayer in the schools in the 1960s, the banning of Bible reading in the public schools in the 1960s, Roe v. Wade, the abortion decision in the early 1970s. And those kinds of issues seem to kind of resurrect religion. Today, it's a pretty powerful force. Look at the Republican Party. Its deepest, broadest constituency today is the Christian right.
But there are other demographics outside of religion. Typically, there are differences between voting habits of people who live in different regions.
It depends on the part of the country, because let's take the rural voter. If the rural voter lives in Appalachia, likely to be very poor, may or may not have even a high school education, relatively low voter turnout rates in those areas. But you compare that, let's say, with the farm areas of Minnesota and Iowa, high levels of income, substantial levels of education, high voting. So, any broad generalization is a bit hazardous. Where most of the voters are is in the suburbs. We've evolved into a form of two-party politics that's directed primarily to the middle class. You look across the suburbs of America, that's where the middle class is concentrated, and that's where the highest voting rate levels exist.
All these factors are significant in bringing people to the polls, and as we saw in 2000, a small number of votes can affect a presidential election. This year, experts and the media are predicting an incredibly tight race. And that could mean higher voter turnout.
We had about 51-52% turnout in 2000. I think we're headed for the high 50s, maybe even squeaking into the 60% bracket. And if that should happen, we haven't been there since the 1960s.
Dr. Thomas Patterson of Harvard University is the author of The Vanishing Voter. Along with Patterson's research on why people vote, others have looked specifically at the impact negative campaigning has on voter turnout. And recently, there is conflicting evidence over the impact of negative ads. For more on that, we turn to ILX's Katie Hines.
The 2004 presidential campaign is exposing Americans to television advertisements attacking the candidates' reputations. According to the ILX survey, about 62% of students say they rely on television for their information. Jim Nolan is a political science professor. He says the two types of negative ads used in campaigns affect voters in different ways.
Ads that are critical of other candidates but are based on issues, even if loosely, tend to attract voters and increase their interest in campaigns. Whereas personal mudslinging, quote-unquote, kinds of negative ads alienate voters and make them less likely to vote.
But University of Illinois speech communication professor Scott Altos says attack ads' effects have changed in recent campaigns.
The most recent studies are in agreement with one another that negative ads do not have a demobilizing effect, but actually have a stimulus effect, that more negative advertising increases turnout and negative campaigning increases turnout rather than decreases it.
ILX showed two University of Illinois students two negative ads, one attacking Bush and the other attacking Kerry. Graduate student Deanna Lewis says seeing the ads for the first time made her think more about the candidates.
For me, it would just make me look deeper into the candidate that I'm going to be voting for or the one I'm not voting for. It just make me, do a little bit more research into that.
English student Chris Ludwig says he doesn't find the ads informative or helpful in evaluating President George W. Bush or Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry.
It's not like where you're electing someone to go to Vietnam right now or someone to go to the National Guard right now. I mean, I don't really see how it's relevant to how competent they are to be a president.
And Dr. Bruce Williams of the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois adds that inattentive voters, people who don't follow politics, are the easiest group for politicians to influence. I'm Katie Hines.
Just as there seems to be conflicting evidence on the impact attack ads have on voter turnout, it seems that some government reforms designed to encourage people to vote may not be doing the job. ILX Adam Jodiff has more.
The popular perception is that people can register to vote at the Department of Motor Vehicles office. But when University of Illinois student Julia Neville went to get her driver's license this past summer, she wasn't asked to register.
No one asked me, so, I wasn't aware that they were supposed to.
This is one of the ways the National Voter Registration Act, or Motor Voter, is falling short. It was designed to bring a new group of previously unregistered voters into the electoral process. But there are limits to when office employees can bring up voter registration to customers. And, as Julia found out, sometimes they don't do it. When someone comes into a driver's license facility to change an address, apply for, renew, or replace a driver's license or state ID, employees are required to ask customers if they would like to become registered voters. According to an ILX survey, of the University of Illinois students who went to the DMV since turning 18, about 40% said they definitely were not asked to register, and 27% weren't sure. Only about 35% said they remembered being asked. Illinois Secretary of State Jesse White says he doesn't understand why this is happening.
First of all, I'm shocked to know that they were not asked to become registered voters. They are required to do that, asked you to become a registered voter, and ask you to become an organ donor. And I pledge that I will get after that as early as today to make sure that some corrections are made.
But even if more young people register at the DMV, a report written for the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement says it is not the most effective tool to get people to vote. Another attempt is Election Day registration, which allows people to register and vote in the same day. James Madison University professor Mary Fitzgerald says in the 6 states that have same-day registration, youth voter turnout has increased by 14 percentage points.
But the significance of that finding is that the states with relatively lower turnout, if they were to institute voting reforms that made voting easier, they could even more significantly increase turnout.
Fitzgerald says opponents of Election Day registration fear voter fraud and long lines at the polls.
Also, I think just a big reason, and this counts for all voting reforms, not just Election Day registration, is that existing public officials do not want to implement new laws that may threaten their power structures and could potentially vote them out of office.
But experts like Curtis Gans, the director of the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate, say the steps leading up to voting don't always mean young people will turn out at the polls.
Registration, you know, creates the necessary condition for voting, but only motivation is the sufficient condition for voting.
While reforms like motor voter and same-day registration are well-meaning, the reforms don't get at the heart of the problem. Doug Chapin heads electiononline.org, a clearinghouse for election reform information. He says the money for election reforms could be used elsewhere.
If the goal is to boost turnout, you probably want to make people feel connected to and understand their government and their political process better rather than simply relaxing requirements for people to vote. In some cases, relaxing election requirements is a little bit like unlocking a door that nobody walks through anyway.
Jennifer Phillips leads the National Campaign for Political and Civic Engagement at the Harvard Institute of Politics. She says the sooner the youth are engaged, active voters, the better.
The trends are showing that it's not like they're not voting now and they'll vote someday. They're not voting now and they're staying outside of the system because, frankly, they don't see any role for them in politics. So they're continuing with their community service. They're continuing to be good citizens in other ways.
Some experts argue the importance and necessity for programs like motor voter and same-day registration. But at the same time, others argue 18 to 24-year-olds just need to exercise their responsibility and vote on Election Day. I'm Adam Jadhav.
For some college students, voting on Election Day means voting by absentee ballot. And as ILX's John Gaylor reports, if they decide to vote in their hometown, the burden of finding an absentee ballot falls on them.
University of Illinois student Aisha Hunt stares at her computer monitor. She is looking for an absentee ballot application on the Illinois State Board of Elections website. She thinks she has found the form, but soon discovers that she has not found the application. She realizes it's only a file directing her to her county clerk for more information.
Our website is kind of misleading. It makes you think that you're going to click a site that's going to get you what you need, and it doesn't.
A survey of University of Illinois students conducted by ILX Student Election Project reveals that 41% of students plan to vote in their home county. In order to do so, they must go home on Election Day or request an absentee ballot. The survey also says 42% of the students said they did not know how to request an absentee ballot. Hunt and several other students were asked to search the website for an application, but after minutes of looking, they could not find the form they needed. Graduate students Abby Rhodes agrees that the website misleads visitors.
The places where it says absentee, if you click on it, doesn't really necessarily take you to what you're looking for. It just gives you more information about it.
This is because in Illinois, you can't get an absentee ballot application online. Voters must contact their county clerk's office to get the application. But this process is much easier in Wisconsin and Kansas. All voters have to do is go online, print the form, and return it. Kansas has had forms for both voter registration and advance voting online for several years. Jesse Bourjean is a media contact for the Kansas Secretary of State.
We try to make voting as easy as possible. We feel like putting them online makes them very accessible for people. Fill it out, print it off, and then send it in.
Students who looked at Illinois' website also viewed the election websites for Kansas and Wisconsin. University of Illinois graduate student Abby Rhodes compares these websites to Illinois' site.
Well, I think it's clear that Illinois' system isn't as effective just because it's more difficult to find what you're looking for.
Rhodes says it is difficult to find the time to get an absentee application in Illinois.
Usually when you sit down to do something like that, especially if you're a busy college student, you only have a few minutes and you figure you're going to go to the internet, you're going to get it really quick and just get it taken care of. But once you find out that there are a million steps that you have to go through just to get it done, it is. You have to find another time to do it, or, you know, in many cases, maybe you just can't do it because it requires going home or something like that, and not, you know, you can't always just drop everything to do that.
Kansas does not track the number of advanced voters who got their forms online, but Bourjean believes it encourages voters in Kansas.
It saves the person from having to go to the election office and get the form and then fill it out, or having the form sent to them and then filling it out. This way they can just go onto the internet, access the forms, fill them out, print them off, and then send them in. So I would assume that it has made somewhat of a difference.
One reason other states can put the form online is because the application is uniform for the entire state. But General Counsel of the Illinois State Board of Elections, Colleen Burke, says in Illinois, most counties create their own forms.
There's certain information that would be required, but they can vary in their wording a little bit, as long as they're substantially the same.
Because applications vary, election authorities handle the applications themselves, not the State Board of Elections. Its Executive Director, Dan White, says the board has only general supervisory responsibilities, which allows the county's control of their own elections.
Our general role and our goal, however, you know, is to provide as much uniformity as we can. We do have suggested forms that we offer in the name of consistency and uniformity. And again, you know, they may vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but the content of them has to be statutorily sufficient.
Champaign County Clerk Mark Sheldon says he designed his own system to manage the applications in his county.
It would create a lot of problems for us if we had to incorporate somebody else's form into our system. What would it accomplish? Why would anyone do that?
Sheldon says he can see putting the application on Champaign County's website in the future, but does not agree with the statewide application online.
I would see it creating impediments to people getting their absentee in a timely fashion. Having the state board do it is, I think, a recipe for disaster, quite frankly.
But Colleen Burke, the State Board of Elections counsel, was impressed when she heard other states streamline the process by putting a statewide application online.
I think it's a great idea, and it's one whose time has come. I would encourage mentioning that when you do contact your county clerk, and also, you know, let your local legislators know that that would be a great bill for the upcoming legislative session.
Since there has been no legislation on putting the application online yet, voters should not expect this process to be available for this November's election. But Burke welcomed the idea of an online application, so maybe it will be available in the near future. I'm John Gaylor.
Some experts say the high percentage of young people who vote absentee is a sign that some students just don't feel locally connected to politics. And some students argue that they don't feel connected to politics at the national level either. They say candidates just don't seem to care about them, as ILEC's Jonathan Mendez reports.
University of Illinois student Monica Patel sits in a lecture hall at night. She's there to watch a presidential debate for extra credit.
I am actually very interested to get to know more about, the issues.
The candidates talk about Iraq, tax cuts, and health care, issues that could affect the 18-year-old. But Patel isn't satisfied.
I don't really think they address the youth as much as they should, because the youth is they play a very important role in who should become president.
Although Patel thinks young people play a big role, they don't. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, only 36.1% of eligible 18 to 24-year-olds voted in 2000. The voter turnout among this age group was the lowest of any group by more than 10%. Professor of Telecommunication at the University of Florida, Dr. Linda Lee Cade, says it's a vicious cycle between candidates and young people.
I think our politicians and our political candidates have not felt that younger voters were as important to them. And if young citizens don't participate very much, that incentive and the value that has for our political candidates goes down. The vicious cycle repeats itself then, because if the younger people don't feel involved, don't feel the candidates care about them, then they don't want to get involved, and they don't seek out other avenues of political participation as well.
That's a sentiment echoed by former candidate for Illinois, Lieutenant Governor Jim Nolan, who also handled the campaigns of U.S. Senator Charles Percy and presidential candidate John Anderson. Nolan admits students aren't given much attention.
I think young people would be considered a lower priority because of their low voting history.
Jennifer Phillips leads the Harvard Institute of Politics National Campaign for Political and Civic Engagement. She says politicians should communicate with young people, but young people also need to participate in the process.
I think one of the things that may have to happen this year is that young people step up, make their decision the best that they can, and show that they are a big voting bloc.
Phillips says she is optimistic about the future of the youth vote.
Once they realize their power in the way the system is set up, which is that, you know, those who vote get more attention, I think that things could change.
But some experts think it will take more than a big turnout to change the relationship between politicians and young people. Curtis Gans heads the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. He says politicians may still ignore young people, even if they vote in large number in this election.
It won't reflect what youth turnout is likely to be 2 years from now, 4 years from now, or 8 years from now, because we're not creating the groundwork for youth to turn out on a sustained basis.
Jennifer Phillips and the National Campaign are working to bring young people and politicians together. She says one of the ways to break the vicious cycle is getting to the belief systems of each side.
That's why we have to develop information. That's why we need to do, you know, national surveys, or that's why we do them, to find out, to really have the truth.
It's finding ways to get the information from the surveys about who the youth are and what their interests are into the hands of communities and politicians. It's also important to get the information out to the youth who are interested in voting so that they know how to participate. I'm Jonathan Mendes.
Now, a few things you need to remember if you're planning to vote on November 2nd. There are new requirements. Lindsay Rue has more.
The Help America Vote Act of 2002 says first-time voters will have to show identification at the polling place if they registered by mail. If you registered to vote through a political organization, that is considered registering to vote by mail. When you head for your polling place, be sure to bring valid photo identification. Remember, student IDs will not be accepted as a valid photo ID. And bring something that shows your current mailing address, like a utility bill or a paycheck. Voters in the residence halls can get forms at the dorm's front desk to verify their current address. If you don't have a valid photo ID or something with your current mailing address on it, you will be allowed to vote using something called a provisional ballot. If you cast a provisional ballot, you will have 48 hours to provide the county clerk's office with proper identification. Otherwise, your vote won't count. The Champaign County Clerk's office is located at 1776 East Washington Street in Urbana, known as the Brookins Center. I'm Lindsay Rue.
One final reminder, iElect will provide live election night coverage between 8 p.m. and midnight on cable channel 7 and at i-elect.com. You can also get the latest election returns live here on WILL. This show was a collaborative effort of the University of Illinois Journalism 490 Convergence Class. The program was produced by Michael Altman and Ivana Young. Our executive producers are Adam Jodiv and Emily West. Our reporters are Christy Blandford, John Gaylor, Katie Hines, Ryan Hubbard, Adam Jodiv, Rebecca Klopp, Shiger Merchant, Yesenia Maharo, Ann Sanner, Jessica Hsu, Lindsay Rue, Maureen Wilkie, and Emily West. Other members of the iElect News team are Dan Farnham, Carlene Fisher, Eric Hall, Jonathan Mendez, Stephanie Mitchell, Lynn Okura, and Sterling Sanders. We would like to give a special thanks to Professors Eric Meyer and Nancy Benson and everyone else who has contributed to this project. For more information regarding the stories you heard, or for a written transcript of the program, visit our website at i-elect.com. For the iElect News team, I'm Ann Sanner.
Months, even years of campaign work come down to one night, and NPR and AM 580 News will be there. Join us Tuesday night for comprehensive election coverage from NPR, Illinois Public Radio, and AM 580,
We'll have live updates of the vote counts and local analysis, along with NPR's in-depth look at one of the most historic national votes ever. Full election night coverage begins at 7 o'clock Tuesday night on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
In New Mexico, pinyon trees are under attack by bark beetles. But an audio artist has come to the rescue. He listens for sounds like these and tells property owners if their trees are infested.
That can help them make the decisions on which ones to spray.
I'm Steve Kerwin. Join me for Art for the Sake of Science next time on Living on Earth from NPR.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.